Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the past 3 weeks, more than 600 people have died in political violence in Kenya. On December 27th, voters went to the polls to elect a president and parliament, and the country's current president, Mwai Kibaki, was declared to be the winner in the presidential contest. Immediately, this drew protest from opposition in that country, particularly from people who were supporters of the Orange Democratic Movement and its leader, Raila Odinga. They said that the election was stolen, and violence has been a result. And many people worry that this violence that is fueled by ethnic tension may well increase. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the election, the violence that has followed, and the prospects for a peaceful resolution. And our guest is Makao Mutua. He is SUNY Distinguished Professor and Floyd H. and Hilda L. Hurst Faculty Scholar at Buffalo Law School, the State University of New York. He is also the director of the Human Rights Center and teaches international human rights and international law. He's also been associate director at the Harvard Law School Human Rights Program, was the director of the Africa Project at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, and has conducted many human rights, diplomatic, and rule of law missions to countries in Africa, Latin America, and Europe. In 2002 and 2003, while he was on sabbatical in Kenya, he was appointed by the government as chairman of the Task Force on the Establishment of a Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. The task force recommended a truth commission for Kenya. During that same time, Professor Mutua also was a delegate to the National Constitutional Conference. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number to use if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Mutua, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am fine, thank you. And yourself?
Not bad.
We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you for having me.
There are certainly many reasons to doubt the outcome of the election, at least in the presidential voting. Is there any reason to doubt, in fact, that that this election was irregular, to say the least, and perhaps rigged, to say the worst?
Well, I think as we speak now, it appears evident that there were problems with the tallying of the ballots, especially presidential ballots. My understanding, and I was in Kenya myself for 2 weeks between in the middle part of December, when the electioneering was going on, the campaigning was going on. My understanding is that the voting was actually problem-free for the most part. People cast their ballots pretty much peacefully. It was only when the balloting of the presidential ballots took place, the tallying of the presidential ballot took place, that problems surfaced. There were allegations that some of the numbers from the strongholds that supported the president, that their numbers were inflated, and that caused the ruckus that is there today.
Mm-hmm. I think in one of the stories that I read, there was a quote from someone, and I think that it was someone associated with the U.S. government, but I wouldn't swear to it at this point. Essentially, the person said that there were so many problems that it would be difficult to determine who won the election.
I think that is right. What you have in the election results is really almost a replica of what we had in this country in 2000 between Bush and Al Gore, when the count of the ballots was contested because of what happened in Florida. But what we also noticed there, which is what we've noticed in Kenya, is that the two candidates got equally, or rather, got the same number of votes, roughly the same number of votes, around 4 million. And I think it is the guess of many analysts that that whoever won the election could not have won it by more than 100,000 votes. Mm-hmm. So you have a divided electorate, essentially, down the middle. And when you have an election that close, I think it becomes very easy to steal the election.
I think that some people have taken a look at the results of the voting for parliament, and they have observed that the Orange Democratic Movement, they won apparently 99 seats, And the president's party, the Party of National Unity, Mr. Kibaki's party, only won 43. Mm-hmm. And they would suggest that if that was the if that's any indicator of the way people might have voted in the presidential race, mm-hmm. that would cast some doubt on this idea that somehow it was that close between the two men.
Well, you know, so on the face of it, you know, you are correct that the ODM, the Orange Democratic Movement, garnered 99 seats, and the Party of National Unity, the PNU of the president, garnered 43 seats. But what you should also realize is that political parties that also supported the president and supported the PNU garnered a lot of seats as well, so that when you put together those other small parties, which got around 35 seats, which supported the PNU, then you have the president's party, the PNU, with about 78 seats. What has also happened subsequently last week is that the president appointed the third serious candidate in the race for the presidency, that is Mr. Kalonzo Musyoka, who was running on the party of the Orange Democratic Movement Kenya. He got about a million votes in the election and got 16 members of parliament elected. He has now joined the president's side. So that gives the president's side around 94 seats. To ODM's 99. What I should also tell you is that in the election for the Speaker of Parliament, which took place yesterday, the candidate for the Orange Democratic Movement received 105 votes to 101 votes for the candidate who was supported by the government. Mm. So I would say that the strength of the members of Parliament for either of the two sides, ODM on one side and PNU on the other side, is roughly equal in the parliament.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that it is true, at least, again, according to what I read, that the last poll that was conducted before the election mm-hmm. Did indeed show Mr. Odinga and Mr. Kibaki to be very close, with a slight edge to Raila Odinga and Mr. Musyoka as a very distant third. So
yes.
At least at that time, I guess, if one's to believe that poll, indeed support for the two candidates was running very close.
Yes, you're right about that. You know, opinion polling for political purposes in Kenya is a new phenomenon. And so Kenyans are just getting used to the fact of polling. And of course, you and I know that polls can be unpredictable, as we just saw in New Hampshire mm-hmm. last week with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But what happened is that I would say, 8 weeks, more than 8 weeks prior to the contest in Kenya in December, Mr. Raila Odinga had been leading in the polls with anywhere from between 1 and 6 or 7 points. However, in the last 2 weeks of the contest, in the last polls released, the contest was, you know, tightened. In one poll, which was released by Gallup, I think Mr. Kibaki was ahead by 44 to 43, I believe. Another poll that was released by a Kenyan polling agency showed Mr. Odinga ahead by several points. So it tightened towards the end. So you're right. I mean, it was, and Mr. Musyoka, of course, came third with about between 8 and 10% of the votes. Mm-hmm. So it was a very close contest.
Well, now I suppose the question is, at this point, what is to be done? And is there something that can be done to look at the results, to try to come up with a conclusion that a majority, at least, of Kenyans, whether they were supporters of Mr. Odinga or Mr. Kibaki, mm-hmm. would accept?
Yeah, the result.
You know, yes. How can you come up? Yes. How can you come up with a result that most everybody is going to accept?
It's going to be very difficult because let me try to explain this in a way that your listeners, you know, can get to it quickly. You know, the contested election results and the violence that we have seen over the last, you know, several weeks is a symptom of deeper problems. The election results simply gave, I think, vent and an outlet to these angers to burst to the surface. And I'll just, briefly, explain what these angers are based on. Number one, Kenya, is a country in the making. It's a nation in the making. It is not really a coherent country. And people like to think of Kenya as a beacon of peace in a turbulent region. But people must understand that Kenya is a post-colonial state. And what that means is that Kenya was, like many other African countries, created by the British by forcibly amalgamating, you know, 40 different ethnic groups together, groups which had lived separately previously. In the 1890s, the British, carved off Kenya and created this new state. So what has been happening since 1890 to date is the process of nation building. And that process has not been always successful. There are moments of hope, but there are moments of despair. Certainly, I think throughout the entire colonial period, the British used the device of divide and conquer in order to rule. And so it was not until 1964, when Kenya became independent, that Kenyans themselves began the process of nation building. So the process of nation building in Kenya is but only 44 years old. Unfortunately, for much of that 44-year period, when Kenya has been ruled by Kenyans, much of that period has been defined by autocratic governments, which were highly repressive. Certainly, that was the case under the founding president, Mr. Jomo Kenyatta. It was certainly true under Daniel Arap Moi, who ruled from 1978 when Kenyatta died to 2002. So it was only really in 2002 when Mr. Moi and Mr. Kenyatta, the son of the founding president, were defeated in the election, and Mr. Kibaki won that election. That was the first time that Kenyans really experienced a democratic state. Mm-hmm. And so the last 5 years, were the years that Kenyans were looking to for hope. Unfortunately, those five years have been defined by corruption by the government, by growing ethnic tensions, by the failure to give the country a new constitution, by the failure to spread the benefits of economic growth. There has been economic growth around 6% a year, but there has been no trickle down of those benefits. As I speak to you, about 50% of Kenyans live on less than a dollar a day. So you have a large segment of the population that is disaffected, that is poor, and that is angry. And they were hoping that this political process that took place in the elections would provide some relief. Mm-hmm. And the fact that then the candidate that many of those who are poor supported, Mr. Raila Odinga, did not emerge victorious, or at least in their view felt the election was stolen from him, I become extremely angry. So that's where the anger is coming from. Mm.
Let me again introduce the guest for this hour, Makau Mutua. He is SUNY Distinguished Professor and is also the Floyd and Hilda Hurst Faculty Scholar at Buffalo Law School at State University of New York. He's director of the Human Rights Center and also teaches international human rights. We're talking about what has been going on recently now in the last couple of weeks in Kenya, the violence that has erupted after the disputed December 27th presidential contest there. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
Can I just add something?
Yes, sir.
Just to add that I have a new portfolio here that is keeping me quite busy. I'm the interim dean of the law school.
Ah, all right.
In Buffalo, New York. So for those of your listeners who are our alumni, who remember me, I just want to let them know that, I'm now acting in that capacity until we find a new dean. For the next 8 months.
All right. Certainly all these responsibilities, no doubt, keeping you very, very, very busy.
Very, very, very busy. And I should also say, by the way, I have a connection to your part of the country. I went to high school in Fisher, Illinois.
Really?
I did. In 1974 and 75, I was there as an exchange student. in Fisher, Illinois. So I know Champaign-Urbana very well.
Well, we are indeed happy to have you here with us on the program. And, of course, would be happy to have questions from other people who are listening. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, in the reporting on the conflict that's happened since the election, there has been its ethnic dimension has been pointed out. And certainly it is true that the president, Mr. Kibaki, is a Kikuyu. This is the country's largest ethnic group. And Raila Odinga is a Luo, so it's another ethnic group. So you can read it that way. At the same time, I think it is true that there have been various conflicts, various places around the world that had ethnic dimensions, but that did not completely explain what it was that was going on.
That's
people
correct.
Weren't necessarily fighting each other just because they were from different ethnic groups, but what it was about was clearly it was about political power in that country. Is that really what we're talking about here?
Well, there is, as I mentioned, there is a sense in which a national Kenyan psychology has not been fully developed, in which people of different ethnic groups have not transferred their loyalties from their ethnic groups to the nation to create a Kenyan identity, a full Kenyan identity. This affects, Kikuyus, affects Luos, affects everyone in the country, because nation building is a project that is incomplete in Kenya. However, I should say to you that there has been a particular tension between the Kikuyu and the Luo, and by extension then, the elites of those groups. At independence, Jomo Kenyatta, who was the first president, was a Kikuyu. His vice president was Oginga Odinga, who is Raila Odinga's father, who was a Luo. Mr. Kenyatta hounded Mr. Odinga out of power in the mid-60s and detained him and prosecuted him for many years. Mr. Kenyatta's government also was accused of orchestrating the assassination of Tom Mboya, a labor leader who was a Luo and who was perceived to be a threat to Mr. Kenyatta. Those two events created a tension between the groups in the country and a psychology of victimhood among the Luo, and conversely, a feeling of superiority among the Kikuyu, the largest group in the country. And when we say the largest group, we just mean about 20% of the country's population. So they are still a minority of the whole, but they're the largest group, so to speak. So there has been that tension. So, in a sense, the contest that you see today has been as those echoes of the past of, Kikuyu privilege and Luo victimization.
Yeah.
And I think it was in this particular election, the Luo felt that this was their turn to take the mantle of power. The fact that the election is said to have been stolen from them, obviously stokes those ethnic passions, so that a lot of the anger is concentrated in Luo country, but also in other areas where Mr. Odinga was able to mobilize groups to support him.
Mm. And I guess just to make things that much more complicated, the previous president, the past president, Daniel Arap Moi, is a member of yet another group, and I believe that he had thrown his support behind Mr. Kibaki.
Yes, Mr. Moi, the previous president, who was in fact a dictator, I should say, ruled for 24 years, had thrown his support behind Mr. Kibaki. But it is interesting to note that the Kalenjin group from which he comes rejected both him and his sons in the elections and voted overwhelmingly for Mr. Odinga.
Mm.
So a lot of the violence, in fact, that you've noticed in the news, for example, the burning of a church in Eldoret, where about 50 Kikuyus were burned to death in a scene that was reminiscent of the Rwanda genocide. Those killings were carried out by the Kalenjins, not by Luos.
And it is that very event, I think, and then more generally what's been going on there that lead people to think about just how bad something like this could become. They think about Rwanda. They think about, at least in many of the stories that I've read, it raises the possibility that we might see something like civil war in Kenya. Is it possible, do you think, that what we have seen so far could escalate to that point?
I think what is shocking to many people is that, Kenya has not been associated with these kinds of scenes where you see people being burned in churches, where you see police shooting people in the back, where you see a government that does not want mediation of a conflict, where you see refugees created by their hundreds of thousands. I mean, in a span of the first 6 days of the conflict, 300,000 Kenyans were internally displaced. That is slightly less than 1% of the country's population in 6 days. That is an enormous number. 600 people were killed in a country that really is regarded by many as a place that is more stable and more peaceful than any of its neighbors, except for Tanzania, which is much more peaceful. So this is a shock that people have. What is also, I think, shocking to people is that Kenya has the largest middle class in the region. And we tend to think of middle classes as a buffer, between groups that might want to explode into conflict. But as I said, there are these ethnic tensions. The question is whether they can spiral out of control. What I want to say is that much of the violence that you are seeing in Kenya is concentrated in areas where people are the poorest and is concentrated in areas where people are unemployed. You are not seeing the violence in the upper scale areas of the country. You are not seeing the middle classes involved directly in confronting the police and security forces. So you have a lot of disaffected people in the slum areas and in the poor countryside who are taking up, rocks and machetes to attack their fellow citizens. So that is why I was saying that although it is tribalized, the violence is tribalized, it's also, inspired, by this dispossession and the marginalization of the people whose anger has been stoked by this election, which is perceived to have been stolen.
We are at our midpoint here. Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We're talking with Makau Mutua. He is a SUNY distinguished professor and currently is interim dean of the University of Buffalo Law School, State University of New York. He's also director of the Human Rights Center and teaches international human rights and international law. And questions again are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Apparently, there is a plan to send a delegation, an African delegation, led by Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations. I believe also Graça Machel, who's the wife of Nelson Mandela, was supposed to be part of this. There's been some delay because Mr. Annan is ill, but there apparently is still this plan for them to go, although at the same time I have read comments from someone in Mr. Kibaki's government who essentially said, look, the election is over, we won. There's no need here for mediation.
Yes.
Do you think that indeed that's going to happen? That is, Mr. Annan's group will go, and if Mr. Kibaki's government says, well, there's nothing to talk about here, will in fact that do any good?
Yeah, I think, Kenya is not impervious to international pressure. Kenya is, one of Africa's, most developed economies. It exports a lot of goods outside the country. It also receives a lot of direct and indirect investments, from many countries, including the West. It's a recipient also of about, I believe, 2 million in tourists a year. So it's susceptible to international pressure and mediation. That is why I think that efforts by Kofi Annan, by Graça Machel, and by other eminent Africans is extremely important, to try to bring the two sides together. My understanding is that actually there may be a willingness on the part of Raila Odinga and Mwai Kibaki to sit down together to resolve, you know, this dispute, but that the people around them do not want them to do so. The people around Mr. Kibaki feel that a mediation can only result in him losing some power. The people around Mr. Odinga feel that a mediation might result in him accepting something less than the presidency. And some of them feel that perhaps it's better for Mr. Odinga and his group to continue with mass action. These are, you know, public protests to force Mr. Kibaki out of power. So there is that, you know, sort of divide and intransigence on both sides. But I think that international mediation, international pressure, you know, brought to bear on the two sides by, you know, countries like Britain, the United States, the African Union, I think Mr. Kofi Annan's group will be very, very important. I will not take very seriously some of the comments which I hear on both sides today. I think that's a lot of that is public posturing on both sides. You know, Kenya has always been able to overcome these situations which look conflictual. My hope is that the better senses will prevail. I mean, look, what are the options here? We have three options. Option number one is to recount the ballots for the president to determine who actually won the election. That's option number one. Option number two is to create a post of a prime minister for Mr. Odinga so that Mr. Odinga becomes the head of government and Mr. Kibaki becomes the head of state in a coalition government where they will share power. Option number three is to have a rerun of the election where the two sides go back to the people for a revote. So those are the options. And a mediation would have to emerge with one of those three options.
It would seem to me that perhaps the easiest, I'm sure that they all would be difficult, that somehow the easiest one would be the second one that you mentioned. I would think that having a recount that people would accept might be difficult. Having a rerun of the election might be difficult. Although at the same time, as you say, only one man can be president at a time. So yeah, there would continue to be a struggle over each man's power. And I would expect that Mr. Odinga's supporters would continue to argue that if there was fraud in the election, that's not something that they should just accept.
Yes.
And of course, though the problem is then for them, the only acceptable conclusion would be for Mr. Odinga to be declared the president, which doesn't seem to be terribly likely either.
Yes, no, it is not likely to happen. I mean, look, there are problems with all these options. Mm-hmm. The option of a recount of the ballot is tenuous, simply because we hear that some of the ballots have been lost and some of the records have been falsified. So, you know, if you go back to chase down the paper trail, you might not be able to get, you know, the correct figures there. So there's a problem there. The option of a revote is fraught with peril because, you know, how are you going to conduct an election in a country that is now so polarized? Is it possible for people to actually go and campaign without there being serious conflict being stoked? You know, at this moment, can a country really go through another election at this moment? So that's another problem that one must look at. The option of sharing power, where Mr. Odinga becomes a prime minister and Mr. Kibaki becomes, you know, remains as president or head of state, is also a difficult one because these two men worked together in 2002 when they defeated Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta, who was Mr. Moi's protege in KANU. Mr. Odinga supported Mr. Kibaki. There was a tacit agreement that Mr. Kibaki would serve for one term instead of the two terms that are allowed by the Constitution and step down so that, you know, Mr. Odinga would run for president. There was also a promise that Mr. Odinga would be appointed a prime minister by Mr. Kibaki when they won that election 5 years ago. Mr. Kibaki reneged on that memorandum of understanding, the MOU that was reached between him and Mr. Odinga. Mr. Odinga then carried out a campaign within government. He was a minister in the government, of opposing the government and opposing the proposed constitution, and defeated the government's constitutional proposal in the 2005 referendum that was held. And then Mr. Kibaki sacked him from the cabinet. So it's very difficult for me to see how the two men can work together. You would have a divided government, Mr. Odinga being a prime minister, presiding over the cabinet and the parliament, Mr. Kibaki being the president. That may be a recipe for disaster, because you could have the two offices could be engaged in a federal duel. Hmm. You know, so it's there are no good options here, no good options.
Something else, and I would ask you to talk about is your involvement with the this task force on the establishing a justice commission.
Yes, what we were trying to do in 2003, when Mr. Kibaki and Mr. Odinga and the rest of the people in the National Rainbow Coalition came to power after defeating KANU, was to make a break with the past, was to look at Kenya's history since independence, to excavate that history, to examine it, and to see where, you know, Kenya had gone wrong, and to see what we could do to correct those mistakes. So we proposed to establish a truth commission, much in the same vein that South Africa established a truth commission, which was headed by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, to look at the crimes of apartheid and to see how the country could be reconciled. So my task force, which I chaired, you know, traveled throughout the country. We took testimony from Kenyans from all walks of life. We asked people if they wanted a truth commission, and people responded by an overwhelming majority of about 90% to endorse a truth commission. The mandate of the truth commission would have been to examine political crimes, assassinations, government-sponsored violations, violations of economic and social rights, to identify the perpetrators of those crimes, to allow victims to tell their stories, and to find ways to heal the country by providing some justice, by sanctioning the most egregious offenders, and by providing restitutional compensation to the victims. We felt that this cathartic experience was important for the country if the country was to move forward, because we felt that the country was being held back by the sins of the past. What happened is that once I gave my report to the president, to the people in his cabinet, including people in the opposition, in his government, including people who are now in the opposition, which included Mr. Odinga at the time, opposed the truth commission, because they felt that a truth commission might implicate them in past crimes and past offenses, because most of these people have been involved in either the looting of the public purse, in grabbing land, public land, in allocating to themselves public resources, or in committing, you know, assassinations against other Kenyans. So they felt that this could implicate them and take them out of commission. That's why they opposed it. The opposition and the government opposed my truth commission. That is why, in a way, the choice between Mr. Odinga and Mr. Kibaki is not a choice between a saint and a villain. It's really a choice between two villains, if I may put it that way. And that's why I think it's unfortunate that so many Kenyans are dying, and there's so much destruction, on account of two individuals, who really, in my view, do not have what it takes to lead the country well.
It seems that here, as you've outlined it, the challenge faced by Kenya is other countries certainly have faced and continue to face the same. That is, we have countries that are trying to deal with the colonial experience, countries that were in a sense put together by some colonial power, where we have groups that traditionally see themselves as at least different and distinct, mm-hmm. if not hostile, mm-hmm. and we are somehow expecting them to come together and to have some sense of national consciousness.
Yes.
Where one never existed before. Mm-hmm. And place after place, we've seen just how difficult this can be. Is there any place that you can think of that would serve as a good model for how such a thing can be made to happen?
Yes. I mean, I think that, David, I think that we can agree that all countries, all states are products of violence, right? Mm. I mean, there's no state that has been a product not of violence. But at some point, a state reaches a point of irreversibility where you create a national zeitgeist, a national consciousness, where then people feel that they have, you know, a common destiny and common identity. You know, you think of the French as having such a thing, and you recently, before we had all those riots, we used to think so. Or the British, or the Americans even, although they are so diverse, or other nations. That is what, you know, nation building is all about. In the case of Africa, you know, you have had a history of trauma after trauma. So there was a trauma of, first of all, you know, slavery. You know, let's not forget this. Then you had the trauma of colonization. Then you had the trauma of post-colonialism, which is, you know, black-ruled states in the context of the Cold War, where either the West or the East supported this or that regime, and those regimes became dictatorial, one-party states, military dictatorships, and so on. So there really has been no relief for Africans to really, you know, create their own societies and create this national consciousness. There are a few countries, however, to directly answer your question, there are a few countries where this has happened. Tanzania is one place. Tanzania is just to the south of Kenya. No one talks about it. It's one very peaceful country. I don't know whether you will remember the founding president of that country, Julius Nyerere, was an individual who was committed to the development of a national psychology, one national language, Kiswahili. I myself lived in Tanzania for 3 years in the early 80s, and I can tell you that never once did anyone ask me what my tribe was. If you go to Kenya today, the first thing that people will ask you or will want to know about you is what tribe you belong to. Mm. That is the extent of the failure of the National Building Project in Kenya. So in a sense, what I'm trying to say is that the role of the independence leadership was very critical in creating a national psychology, where the independence leader did not try to forge that national identity, you have had continuing problems. In Kenya, Kenyatta did not do it. He tribalized the state. He gave privileges to his Kikuyu group. He alienated other groups. And consequently, what you have is, you know, this fractured society. In the case of Tanzania, Nyerere did the exact opposite, perhaps because he came from a very small group himself. He did not come from one of the dominant groups. He built a national culture, a national identity, a national psychology. So there is hope that this can be done. But I think it requires visionary leadership. It requires people who think beyond their own immediate interests, people who think of the national interest, and people who are interested in nation building. And this is what Kenya has been lacking. Our political class is essentially lazy and opportunistic. You know, they find it much more convenient for them to appeal to primordial instincts, to tribalism, to stoke ethnic demagoguery, to get to power, as opposed to focusing their campaigns on issues and ideologies. So this is a problem that we have had of a political class that is stricken by what I would call philosophical poverty. It's a philosophically poor class because it's bankrupt intellectually. That's the problem.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I have a caller we'll get right to just quickly. Let me introduce again the guest, Makao Mutua. He's SUNY Distinguished Professor and Floyd and Hilda Hurst Faculty Scholar at Buffalo Law School, State University of New York, where he is also currently serving as the interim dean. He's director of the Human Rights Center. He teaches international human rights and international law. We're talking about Kenya and what's happened there over the last few weeks, as there has been a good deal of violence, politically motivated violence, going back to the disputed December 27th presidential election. We have a caller here, someone in Effingham. We'll talk with them right now on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, I just want to say in passing that I visited Buffalo, and it's a beautiful, aging old town, and I spent a week there. There on, I think, the south side, the markets and all that, but it is, like any older entity, is, decaying somewhat. But I have a question, a comment. If, could you tell me what is the national treasure or the source of money in Kenya?
Yes. Kenya was the entry port for investments and capital during the colonial period. You may recall that Kenya was designated as a white man's country early on, like Australia, South Africa, or Rhodesia, because the British settlers felt that Kenya was a place they could settle for forever. And as a consequence, it became a magnet for a lot of investment in the region. So it has a highly developed infrastructure. It has a highly developed agricultural sector. It produces a lot of cash crops and food crops, tea, coffee, important exports. Tourism is also a very important form of capital accumulation in Kenya. It's a hub. It's a hub in East Africa for transportation. It has a fast growing export manufacturing sector as well. When I looked at the figures this year, 90% of Kenya's budget was funded from local collections, from local tax collections. It was not reliant on external aid.
Okay, then, so tourism and adequate infrastructure brings money.
Yes.
All right. Well, that answers that. The agriculture is not a big thing there.
It's a big thing. It's a very big thing.
Well, it is big.
It's all big. Right. It's big, for sure.
And the landowners are whom?
The landowners are divided. Many of the largest landowners, is a mixture of indigenous, big landlords, but also international multinationals.
That come and farm the land.
That come and farm the land. Del Monte is one. Brook Bond is another one that grows tea. And, so there are many, many landowners there who are foreign, but also those ones who are local. Part of the conflict that you're hearing, you're reading about in Kenya is a perception by many people in the Rift Valley, which is the country's breadbasket, where many Kikuyus have gone. These are the members of Mr. Kibai's ethnic group and bought up land, yes, and are doing farming there. Mm-hmm. And so they are perceived as having displaced local people there.
And then the money goes out of the country after taxes.
The money from the corporation, certainly some of it goes out of the country. But I would say that much of the money that is made by Kenyans stays at home.
And, well, just as an aside now, Great Rift Valley is the mother of all of us, is she not?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'll continue on with my statement. The your words that the folks in Kenya have a choice between two criminals.
Yes.
Well, no matter and their democracy, so-called democracy, is not very old, is it? When did they get free of the British?
The Kenyans became independent in 1964.
64.
Yeah, so you're talking about a 44-year period.
All right. So now what I'm about to say, I know it's going to make a lot of people angry.
No, that's quite okay. Go ahead, sir.
But the paradigm which you have articulated during this hour is indicative of the world at large. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. and everywhere else that a so-called democracy is extant, there is the choice between criminals. In the U.S., it is no different. We have a fellow here who is still out of jail. Mm-hmm. His name is Tom DeLay. He is a national figure. He was known as the Hammer. He smashed his way through the Congress. It was his way or the highway. And people in the West, namely, have this immunity because they have enough to eat and they have their trinkets. And they have a little money, so there is nothing goes to the streets. It takes a war. That's why the war in Iraq now is not being protested here, because there's no draft. But when you begin to drag in those people who are at the bottom of society and they become cannon fodder, then when you get to those people in the upper working class, then the trouble begins. But I agree with your and have been well informed by your comments. So, well, I'll ring off, and I enjoyed it very much, and thank you, David.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Let me just say to the caller, whose name now I did not get, let me just say that I appreciate his comments. You know, Winston Churchill, the English statesman, the famous English statesman, said that democracy was the worst form of government except for all the others. I guess what he meant by that is that democracy is not a perfect system. It has many problems. But if you compare democracy to all the other systems, which range from monarchies to theocracies to dictatorships, you will find that democracy is better than those others. But you are right, sir. You know, your critical analysis of democracy is just right on point. Democracy can be a funnel for circulating cynical elites, for circulating into power those who have a lot of money. And we've seen in this country, certainly, you know, this happen. We've seen the law turnover in Congress. You know, people who get elected are people who have access to resources, and people who come from the upper classes. There's no question about that. That is also true in Kenya. So democracy has that tendency to favor and give an advantage to those individuals in society who are wealthy and who are well connected and who are powerful. There's no question about that, sir. And, you know, our project is to try to see if we can diminish, you cannot eliminate, but diminish the negative proclivities, the negative tendencies of democracy, to make sure that we take out money in the political process, to make sure that we give more people a voice in the political process. So that individuals who talk about issues and who talk about, human welfare can be heard. It's very difficult in a democracy to do that. Democracy is slow. Democracy is not perfect. And so I agree with you that you will find many, many criminals in power. And certainly that is true of every country in the world. I agree with the caller.
We'll try to get one more caller here. We have just very little time, but we'll go to Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think it can tie Tom DeLay directly to this Vulture Fund, where they're gaming, mainly Americans are gaming the loan structure in Africa. And I think it's a good corruption to highlight, because I think it's only the exceptional corruption, though. I think the whole IMF and structural adjustment policy that's been imposed upon Africa needs to be pointed at too, in exacerbating what were existing tensions but were never really except at times of maybe colonial manipulation, had never really been that dangerous to Kenyans amongst themselves. So I really do think that's an important thing to highlight, and I appreciate also you're bringing the colonial history. A lot of people say that's an excuse, but when you have the backdrop of Siad Barre flipping back and forth between the Soviets and the U.S. through the last several decades, it has to have had an effect. And
yes.
So I know there's only a moment left, so I'll leave you to. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, thank you. I'll just quickly say that I agree with the caller that it is true that there is an internal dimension to the problem that Africa faces. There is certainly a failures from within the political classes in Africa itself. But let us not forget that there is a large international dimension to what is happening in Africa today. The international political economy, in many respects, is scandalous. It has stripped Africa of its resources. It has made Africa dependent on the West. for most of the Cold War period, the West and the East supported governments which were rapaciously greedy and corrupt and murderous. Look at, for example, the case of Zaire, or now the Congo, or look at Liberia, for example, or look at Somalia, which the caller mentioned. You know, these countries were ravaged because of the support that was given to those dictators by both the East and the West. So we cannot forget, these external factors.
We will have to leave it at that with our thanks to our guest, Mikhail Mutua. He's currently serving as interim dean of the University of Buffalo Law School, State University of New York, where he teaches international human rights and international law. He's also been associate director at the Harvard Law School Human Rights Program and was also served as director of the Africa Project at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. And he's been involved with a number of human rights, diplomatic, and rule of law missions to countries in Africa, Latin America, and Europe. Professor Mutua, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir.